Hi, and welcome back to another episode. This is episode number 315. Today, I am joined by Daniel Moss. He is a columnist at Bloomberg Opinion in Singapore. He recently wrote an article named The Chinese Antidote to a COVID-Battered Philippines. It always piques my attention whenever anyone is shining the light on the Philippines and the Philippine economy. We've spoken to Daniel Moss before, and I really enjoy getting Daniel on the show to discuss his view of the Philippines and the Southeast Asian region generally. We have a good catch-up today. We discuss everything from, of course, the Philippines and his article. We discuss COVID, of course. We discuss the President-elect Joe Biden, and we cover much more. So it was a fantastic conversation, and I always enjoy the time spent discussing economics and politics and regional affairs with Daniel Moss. So I hope you enjoy. If you want any of the show notes, and of course the link to the article is in that as well, go to outsourceaccelerator.com/podcast. Enjoy. I'm joined again by Daniel Moss. He's a columnist at Bloomberg Opinion based in Singapore. Hi, Daniel. Thanks for joining us again.
Hi, Derek. Great to be here once more.
You joined us a few months ago now, and there's been so much happening in 2020. So it's good to catch up with you and, of course, tap into your regional expertise. I want to start, Daniel, by talking about an article that you recently wrote for Bloomberg Opinion. The title is The Chinese Antidote to a COVID-Battered Philippines. Now, of course, it piques my attention whenever I see any sort of international news outlet talking about the Philippines. Obviously, I'm a little bit biased that way. But do you want to just introduce that article and what motivated you to write that and what your key insights were from that article?
That article took about a year from gestation to publication. I spent some time in the Philippines, Luzon, the main island, accounts for about two-thirds of the Philippines economy in January. At that point, COVID had barely been given a name. People were talking about it as the Wuhan virus. There were items on the local news that I could see in my hotel that were just referring to it as a fairly localized Wuhan phenomenon. The main story actually was the eruption of a volcano pretty close to Manila, which created havoc in its own way. But the volcano soon faded, and COVID spread, became a global pandemic, and became everything. You know, the work that was to flow from that visit to the Philippines and the conversations I had in and around it was originally designed to be three columns. My editor and I kept writing and rewriting and re-interviewing people in an effort to just get ahead of COVID and find a way to peg it to COVID. And eventually, you know, we were overwhelmed, put the material on the shelf and looked for an opportunity to resurrect. You know, as the year wore on and wore down, there was an appetite for not just, you know, the latest on COVID or the policy response or the political response, but, you know, where were we a year ago? And is there a place that was emblematic of the trends from the last few years pre-COVID? And how is that place doing at the end of the COVID year? So that was the framework in which that became one large 2,000-word-plus column as opposed to three distinct ones.
COVID itself seems to have destroyed any kind of value in pattern recognition and sort of trend analysis, doesn't it? Because it's just tipped everything up, you know, on end, and you have to kind of restart again with any kind of trend analysis, don't you?
Well, it's tipped a lot up. You know, I think as we're not able to get full perspective on this pandemic and what it has wrought, but I think we have more than we do 6 or 9 months ago. You can see some things it completely turned on its head. In other ways, you can see trends that were nascent or trends that were starting to develop pre-COVID that you could argue have accelerated. So COVID has compressed the timeline for them, you know, and expanded the scope of those things. You know, the world was not invented that day in March when the World Health Organization declared it a global pandemic. It has caused significant upheaval, but there was a world that existed before and there will be a world that existed afterwards.
In reflection then, how has Philippine responded, reacted, and you know, where do you see it now after the 9 months of COVID that we've all been going through?
This seems like a cruel twist of fate to many people in many places, but particularly so with the Philippines. You know, the thesis I went there with, Derek, and you and I talked about this, you know, in an earlier conversation, was, look, the Philippines in many ways has been apart from the rest of Southeast Asia, separated by the degree and the nature of its colonial experience, its political development post-World War II, and then more recently, its economic development. Much of Southeast Asia, while growth rates are were still high relative to the rest of the world, they were distinctly off the boil. The Philippines never became a tiger like some of its ASEAN siblings. You know, the Philippines really only started exhibiting tiger-like qualities, arguably, you know, in the last 5 or 6 years. You know, around about 2000, you know, GDP per capita wasn't that much better than where it was, you know, in 1980. But what you saw was economic growth accelerate to average at least 6% in the 5 years prior to 2020. Had the pandemic not come along, it could have clocked 7%. Now, a lot of this has been obscured by people's perceptions about President Duterte and the policy direction that he has pursued. But, you know, look, the Philippines was, for want of a better term, the sick man's sick person of Southeast Asia. You have not been able to say that for the half decade or so prior to January 2020.
Yeah, I don't think people are giving the Philippines enough credit, and I don't know if it's because it's a sort of a hangover from it being the, you know, the sick person of Southeast Asia, but it's just been record-breaking growth year on year for at least half a decade, as you say, and really outpacing China almost, and really not enough people globally are sort of pointing their head up and really recognizing this. It's been an incredible growth story, hasn't it?
Well, it was converging with Chinese rates of growth, but they were doing it from opposite directions. You know, we're used to seeing China stats, you know, in, say, from the 1990s through to the early 2010s, double digit, sometimes as high as 12, 13, 14, 15%. Pre-COVID, China was slowly but surely decelerating, in large part encouraged by the government, to around 6 to then 5.5 to then 5%, and then COVID happened. Philippines was approaching China, but, you know, from the bottom and reaching upwards. You know, there were a couple of things that struck me as unique about that story. One was, you know, President Duterte's well-documented tilt away from the United States, the longtime guardian and before that colonial overlord of the Philippines, tacking toward China. What was that doing in the economic space? It's hard to separate that from the geostrategic sphere, but I did try to look at them quite distinctly. The second thing, an industry you're very familiar with, which is the outsourcing industry, what Philippines people call BPOs, or contact centers, in more common parlance, call centers. The third thing which particularly intrigued me since my move to Singapore was the great export of Philippines labor. The merchant marine globally is packed with Filipino seafarers. I've seen
and the domestic market, and by the way, this has been happening a lot longer than the prevalence of the outsourcing industry.
Well, I think this Look, it is commonplace for middle class families in Singapore to have some kind of live-in help, okay? Whether it's a nanny for young children, whether it's a maid, or it's the ubiquitous term is helper. A fair chunk of those people are and have been from the Philippines. They are healthcare workers in Japan. They are healthcare workers in Western Europe. Filipinos staff the construction industry in the Middle East. You know, one person who I spent some time with on the trip in January said to me, only half jokingly, it's our secret plan to take over the world. You know, I laughed when she first said that. The more I looked at it, the more people I spoke to, you know, maybe she wasn't kidding. So the Philippines has these attributes. And don't forget, you know, the demographic miracle people talk about in Southeast Asia and East Asia generally, that's largely gone now, aside from a couple of places, Philippines, Indonesia, and India. It's basically over everywhere else. So the Philippines has this great demographic profile, if only it can keep its people.
And I think now, you know, one of the big narratives is that previously with the OFWs or the overseas foreign workers that they referred to, you know, as you said, those Filipinos going overseas and earning money and remitting a large portion of their salary back to the Philippines and boosting the Philippine economy. The downside, of course, is there was a massive brain drain. And of course, families were growing up without their parents. And the argument for outsourcing or BPOs is that, you know, you're able to have white-collar professional roles done from the Philippines but working for overseas employers. So there's not the brain drain and families aren't growing up without their parents. So it's kind of a win-win. But, of course, both the OFWs and the BPO industry is flourishing at the moment, which is – or pre-COVID anyway, which is good.
You know, I spent some time at a BPO. Contact center, call center, pick your lingo, one night when most people were on. It was the busiest shift. It was around lunchtime, early afternoon in the United States, you know, prime time for people to call really frankly about anything. It could even be a set of steak knives that didn't arrive. And when I spent time with these people, many of them were young, 20s, early 30s. Flawless English, which works for the BPO setup, right? You know, quite a number of them said, look, if it was not for the BPO, the business process outsourcing industry, I would have to work abroad. You know, like my mother, like my father, like my grandfather. And, you know, there's a pragmatism about this. But there's definitely a social cost. You know, there's a village, a barangay, I believe the local term is, about 2 hours' drive southeast of Manila. The locals refer to it as Little Italy because of the predominance of people who actually found work, you know, in Italy. And you'd visit, you know, the families that were staying behind. And the house, the, you know, late model, you know, Honda SUV, all these things were paid for by remittances from family members abroad. And in turn, what you saw is all sorts of extended family coming in and out of these houses, eating, sleeping. You know, it was hard to tell where one nuclear family began and another ended.
I want to test sort of my economic theory of this whole thing. And I think Philippines is a unique economy because the two main drivers of the economy, which is outsourcing and its OFWs, or the overseas foreign workers, the success of those economies directly depend on the success of external economies. You know, the BPO industry is booming if it has a lot of clients in the US and UK, and those clients and that economy are booming. And same with OFWs, you know, as the economies expand, they need more domestic and also qualified personnel, then in turn, the Philippines booms. And it seems very, very interconnected. You know, and I spoke to, you know, I reflected on this with my partner, and she actually said to me, really any export industry is like this. So for example, in Brazil, if you're exporting commodities, iron ore, you know, all of those are really dependent on the welfare of external economies. But do you see a difference in that, you know, almost 25% of the Philippine economy is produced by the success of third-party economies, effectively?
It is a reminder, if one was needed, and it seems like we need one every day, this voguish idea that globalization is over, globalization is dead, and that's something that instantly happened in June 2016 with Brexit, or November 2016 with Trump's election. It's just a complete fallacy. Look, globalization is alive and well, okay? It's not a bunch of guys sitting in rooms signing treaties, and it's not necessarily about how much cargo is unloaded from a container ship, right? A lot of things that I think a lot of people miss about globalization and why it is still strong, you know, is services. You know, I'm happy to put any nail in the coffin of this idea that globalization is dead. It's clearly not. The experience of the Philippines tells us that it's not. You know, when I was in Little Italy, Derek, you know, there were also some family members who'd been working in the construction industry in the Middle East and working as helpers for households in the UAE, in Qatar, and in Saudi Arabia. These people sitting around the dining room table in that home, 2 hours' drive southeast of Manila, knew way more about the Saudi Arabian fiscal situation. They knew way more about the price of oil that day than me. Very versed in Middle East politics and economics. And one person even gave me, you know, a review of, you know, where crude oil had been in the previous 24 hours.
Yeah, it's amazing. Look, I would argue that the Philippines, as a result of those two major driving industries, would be one of the most globalized countries in the world. You know, it is a developing nation. It is very traditional as a result, and it can be a little bit insular. But because there's these massive drivers, as you say, you know, a lot of the population are spending the sort of formative years of their lives overseas. Another part of the population is working in outsourcing, which is catering to the needs of overseas clients. And the millennials, or the children of the Philippines, all speak fluent English, and they're growing up on a diet of Netflix and Facebook and YouTube. You know, it's sort of a globalized media. I find it sort of one of the most globalized countries there are, really.
Well, why do you think the Philippines doesn't get credit and hasn't received credit? Is it because people's perceptions of the president get in the way?
Look, I think that could be the case, especially when he was first elected, you know, and he was more active. But I think now that's become maybe more of an accepted norm. or just sort of it's become more normalized, and hopefully that people are you know, taking note of the sort of fiscal and economic activity of the country and starting to take up sit up and take notice. Although I am concerned, you know, you look at all the indexes in terms of foreign investment and venture capital, there's not really a lot making it to the Philippines, and people don't really see Philippines as a sort of attractive breeding ground, I suppose. So I'm slightly mystified, because I would think that the Philippines is a fantastic test bed for other industries, because it's English speaking. You know, there is only one effectively state, as opposed to multiple states and legislature to deal with. It's culturally aligned, so it's an incredible test bed to start things here and then expand either to Asia or globally.
So it's interesting you say over to Asia. Again, there's this sense of the Philippines being apart. Why did you say over to Asia?
Yeah, look, I think the Philippines is a little bit of a, it's unique, you know, and actually I see it as, and into the future, this is actually how we're trying to position it, as the gateway between Asia and even China and the West. You know, a little bit how they say Turkey is the gateway between the East and the West. But I see an opportunity for the Philippines to be that gateway, be that bridge between those two huge economies.
You know, it's interesting. A Pulitzer Prize-winning book that I read in advance of the trip, I believe the title is In Our Image. It's a story of America's relationship with the Philippines. And I believe it was by Stanley Karnow, a long-time Time magazine correspondent in Asia. And there's a line, I don't have the book in front of me, there's a line that goes something like this. I was not in Asia. I was not in America. Where actually was I?
It's a fascinating country. I mean, for people that haven't traveled a lot, you know, it's probably, you just kind of, it is what it is. But to come to Asia, in inverted commas, but everyone speaks English, the you know, the average taxi driver speaks English, all of the road signs are in English, and all of the popular culture, not all, but vast majority of popular culture is in English. This is very much an English state. You know, and culturally, that's either good or bad. You know, I think they have been slightly stripped of their own cultural identity, their own language, which is, you know, there's pros and cons to that. But in terms of economic advantage and opportunities for the younger generations, I think it sets them far apart from other developing countries and even other non-English speaking countries in the world.
Well, it's not just English. There are plenty of countries in Southeast Asia where there's a degree of English fluency and widespread use of English. It's the Americanized English that strikes you. For want of a better term, you know, the American accents with which English is spoken. But, you know, then again, when you talk about cultural identity, you know, I'll just sort of second guess myself there. What I did find when I went up onto the north coast of Luzon, there was not a lot of English spoken, Americanized or otherwise. I had been preparing to go down to Cebu to check out the outsourcing scene down there. And I was told that I would probably need someone who spoke Cebuan. I'm like, well, what about Tagalog? No, that's really only spoken around Luzon. You want to go down to the Visayas and Cebu, people will be speaking Cebuan. And I said, well, what about Mindanao? They said, oh, well, that's got its own culture as well. So, you know, it's a massive archipelago, rivaling Indonesia, you know, in terms of its breadth and its scope. But like Indonesia, is it a bit of a sort of a cultural mishmash with a state imposed upon it? Is it a nation or is it a state?
I think it's more of a state, more of a nation than some of the other sort of troubled countries. There is one identity. Now, of course, if you went into individual smaller pockets, and of course there's Mindanao, then people would debate that. But it has a very strong identity. What you say is very accurate, though. This is a country of 7,000 islands, so they're always going to be up against the logistical issues of how you connect all those 7,000 islands. You know, that's a lot of bridges to build. So just by nature of the geography, I think the country will find it hard to sort of enliven the economy right throughout the 7,000 islands. And then also, as you say, with the language there, I believe there's over 100 languages or dialects that are spoken now. And I think that's partly why English has sort of risen to the top, is because, you know, even Tagalog, which is the sort of primary Filipino language, is only really spoken in Luzon, which is the main island. But there's every other dialect. And then, you know, you will get many Filipinos just speaking English, because that is the sort of universal language for all of them, because there's so many dialects. So there are these challenges, but then I suppose, you know, you don't want to strip color out of every country just so that they're more economically viable. This is part of the color and the vibrancy and the joy of this culture. This podcast is brought to you by Outsource Accelerator. We are the world's leading outsourcing marketplace and advisory. We help big and small businesses with their outsourcing needs, and we can help you too. We cover everything from business and staffing strategy, optimal outsourcing structures, implementations, and fully managed services. If you're already outsourcing, about to start, or somewhere in between, then we can ensure that you get the best from outsourcing. That's the best prices, best terms, and of course, the best results from your outsourcing practices. We list over 700 outsourcing suppliers on our website, host this leading outsourcing podcast, and have over 5,000 pages of content. Because we span the entire market, we can ensure that you get the best deal possible. We offer everything from light brokerage, co-managed services, through to fully managed solutions. Get in touch today. Visit us at outsourceaccelerator.com/quote. Mention that you're a podcast listener, and we will give you special attention plus a 10% discount. This is for a limited time only. Go to outsourceaccelerator.com/quote.
Yeah, I quite agree.
You were mentioning earlier Brexit and, you know, potentially the collapse of globalization, as some commentators would sort of like to say, whereas I see it completely going the opposite direction, and we're increasingly globalized. A recent move is the RCEP, and the Philippines is one of those founding members alongside China, and the RCEP being the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership. It's not the best acronym in the world, but what are your thoughts on the RCEP and its effects on the region and also globally?
Its most tangible significance is probably that it exists at all. You know, again, we've been fed this steady diet from the chattering class commentariat about the end of globalization, end of multilateralism, nativism, all those isms. But look, then along comes this trade agreement. You know, we saw kind of the makings of this when many of the Trans-Pacific Partnership members decided to go ahead without the United States. And many people saw the leader of that as, surprise, surprise, Japan, a place once caricatured for its, you know, hidebound resistance to trade and to opening of markets. But there you go. Shinzo Abe, the prime minister who left after 8 years in August, deserves enormous credit for that. So RCEP's a slightly different animal. Look, it's not going to make an enormous impact on gross domestic product for any of its member nations. It's not like there was no trade between them and now there's a lot. It's that, you know, multilateralism is not dead. Just doesn't necessarily involve the United States or Western Europe. And that's where I think the sort of the prejudices might be too tough a term to use, but the North Atlanticist instincts of many chattering class commentators can undo them a bit. Trade agreements, you know, are alive and relatively well. They're just not involving the United States or Western Europe. But to say that they're not happening because they don't involve the US and the EU is ridiculous. So it's that RCEP happened, they got it signed. Okay, we'll see what substantive difference it makes. But at least there's still movement there.
Is it a fool's errand with, you know, as Europe is trying to effectively unwind the EU, and of course, you know, living in the shadow of the Brexit, which in itself has taken about 5 years to establish, you know, is it sort of proving that if you have these big trade agreements, they just don't work? Is this a fool's errand in that now Asia wants to give it a go and it will be a 25-year journey of frustration?
I don't know that the EU is on the verge of unraveling. The UK voted to leave. My sense is that the remaining members may choose to bind themselves even tighter. I mean, you just can't have this hemorrhaging and psychodrama that the UK has exhibited the past 4 years breaking out in every EU country. I just don't see that. So I'm not aware of any serious EU exit movement that gets mainstream adherence anywhere else in the EU.
Your article, of course, talks about China's relationship with the Philippines. And, you know, it's no secret that China is trying to establish its dominance within the region. China is, of course, the biggest partner within the RCEP. India was potentially going to be a part of the RCEP, but they opted out. Do you see, I would assume that China is joining the RCEP with a view to sort of being the biggest beneficiary from this. How do you see China's relationship generally within the region and then, of course, its participation in this RCEP?
I think many countries in Southeast Asia want the US to remain a presence in Southeast Asia. Remember, sort of basically from, certainly from the late 60s through to, you know, more or less the present day, Asia, including China, has prospered under a US political and economic, US strategic and economic framework. Okay, the region has basically been at peace. There's been a relatively, underscore that term, relatively unfettered flow of goods, capital, services, and to a degree, people. You know, China has benefited from that as much as anybody else, right? So that's the first thing to say. In Southeast Asia, where you and I both are, people are very happy to see vigorous US engagement in the region, but they don't want it to upset the increasing political and economic ties with China. They don't want either to be dominant at the expense of the other.
And I suppose that is that's the key to any unification, isn't it? It's mutual benefit. It's not for one member to you know, overly profit from any relationship. Otherwise, there wouldn't be continued synergy there.
Most people I speak to are looking forward to a more professionally and process-oriented US foreign defense and economic policy. Less decision-making with the 3 a.m. tweet. Less policy determined by Tucker Carlson on his evening show on Fox News. A return to a more deliberate, more professionalized policy framework, policy development, and policy execution.
Well, let's go there. I mean, as you mentioned, Southeast Asia is keen to maintain their relationship and ties with the US, which, you know, is, of course, the dominant global economy still for now. And there's been a change in the presidency, or certainly we have a new president-elect, Joe Biden. What do you think will be the impact on Asia as a region and, I suppose, international political economic relationships globally with Biden now at the helm?
Well, I think it'll be a return to a more familiar style of developing policy and implementing it. And hopefully some of these countries will have US ambassadors. Singapore, where I am, hasn't had an ambassador, throughout the Trump years. So I think people are looking to a more, professionalized State Department, a more professionalized Defense Department, where experience is not a dirty word. And, Joe Biden has spent more than half his life in the US Senate. He was, for a long time, either chairman or ranking member of the Foreign Relations Committee. He is an institutionalist. Now, all of that said, it's not like the ground underneath him has stood still for the past 4 years, and even going back before that. You could see, certainly, in the second Obama administration, relations cooling between the US and China. And if you talk to folks who served in economic roles toward the end of the Obama administration, there was definitely a sense of coming apart, and that the next president, he or she, would have to make some calls. They thought it would be she. It wasn't. Trump was elected, and calls he made. There are many forces and constituencies in the United States that are taken into account when policy is set. It's very hard in Washington these days, either on Capitol Hill or K Street, the traditional home of lobbying firms, or really anywhere, to find many people who will proudly put their hand up and say, yeah, I'm an advocate for China. You know, if you go back to the late 1990s, when the US supported China's entry into the World Trade Organization, there were many factors pushing the US toward an agreement, not least of which was cheerleading from the business lobby. Business still does not want a rupture, a complete and utter rupture with China, but they're picking their shots. In an interview with the New York Times a couple of days ago, President-elect Biden showed no inclination to hurry a relaxation of at least the first round of tariffs that Donald Trump imposed. You know, you could make the case, and this is one of history's great what-ifs, that if Hillary Clinton had been elected in 2016, would the substantial thrust of US policy toward China be markedly different than that pursued by Donald Trump? Yes, the signaling would be different. The framing of it would be different. And there might not have been tariff after tariff after tariff after tariff, with a sort of a stick it in your pipe and smoke it view. But, you know, that was never going to be a warm embrace of China either.
I'm concerned that Biden, he is more liberal, of course, than Donald Trump. He is far more professional and diplomatic. I think, you know, everyone would agree. So I imagine he's not going to be causing fights, and his agenda will be to calm existing friction that Donald Trump has created. However, he is quite traditional, and certainly in terms of outsourcing, he's pretty much anti-outsourcing, especially when he was working in the Obama administration. And even with this election, he was talking of, or one of his pledges is to establish a Biden offshoring tax penalty and a Biden Made in America tax credit. Now, I believe what I see is, you know, I really believe in globalization, and I see it as a huge boon for the entire globe and all of its inhabitants. But I think there's generally a negative connotation with globalization, with the fear aspect of if we globalize, we're all going to lose our jobs to the developing world. And my concern is that there's not going to be any president ever that's ever going to win any votes by saying we are pro-offshoring, we are pro-overseas jobs, we are pro-globalization. How do you see those things really fitting together? Because, you know, Biden is really quite anti-offshoring. And of course, Donald Trump was when he first started his term, although he didn't really follow through so much. How do you see that sort of trend towards globalized workforce, globalized employment, and the tolerance of it?
Well, I don't think any politician in any country, and I've lived and worked in half a dozen in the course of my career, is going to win any votes, whether you're in KL, Singapore, Tokyo, London, by putting up your hand saying, yeah, I'm going to say something now that my opponents can interpret as being anti-home worker, pro-workers on the other side of the country, where half other side of the world, a place where half the voters have never been. No one's going to say that. So, you know, that has to be said just by way of throat clearing. Another thing to take into account is, you know, Biden is will take the reins January 20, you know, of an economy that is suffering under the weight of the economic upheaval that COVID has wrought. Unemployment has come down from its peak. GDP growth has returned. Retail sales have come back. Weekly filing for unemployment benefits has come down. But they're still greatly elevated from a historical perspective. So you've got to consider that as well. And the third thing is, just because you say you're pro-American worker and pro-onshoring, and by the way, Obama tried to sort of get some things going with this as well, that doesn't mean that the outsourcing industry is not going to find a way to flourish. I think a lot of what is said now really reflects the political center of where America is and the political center of gravity within the Democratic Party. You know, I'm going to push back a bit, Derek. I mean, I'm not sure that, you know, Joe Biden has spent his career necessarily being anti-offshoring. I mean, he sure wouldn't call it that. But you've got to remember, he represented Delaware in the Senate for many decades. And indeed, the auditorium in front of which where, you know, he's given some of the most important speeches of the campaign and some of the most important events of the post-campaign has been an arena / function hall branded by Chase, the bank and credit card company. Delaware is a big place for credit cards, trusts, all sorts of things to be incorporated. You could argue that in his long career in the Senate, Biden has been sympathetic toward the credit card industry. Now, I don't know about you, but I can't tell you how many times I've called with a question about a credit card statement and I end up talking to someone in Manila.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, look, I think anyone sensibly and certainly with kind of economic awareness and insight knows that globalization is a positive force. It's kind of a network effect where there's a multiplier of the more people involved in one ecosystem, the ecosystem gets more powerful, gets more efficient. And, you know, it's better if you have 8 billion people in one highly efficient ecosystem with minimized friction. And I think that's the way inevitably the world is going, because it's going to be technology that is catalyzing this. And I think politics to a degree will lag behind, because it's not popular, as you say. It never could be popular to say that we're going to give jobs overseas, because ultimately the net effect is that it's beneficial for our people. That's a really hard sell, but I think inevitably it's going to come round to that. And hopefully if people have foresight, you know, people will embrace globalization. And certainly consumers have embraced globalized supply of goods, and consumers and businesses have embraced automation, and both from software and robotics. And, you know, all of these things have potentially a more significant impact on employees and employment than offshore staffing. So it's intriguing, isn't it? You know, it brings us into the whole realm of technology, where we're going with technology. And also, you know, that I see you write on a little bit as well is the AI and automation of these call centers. And is that a big threat to employees generally, but also call centers, which are so dependent on people doing the work?
Well, you know, when I was there in January, I did ask people at call centers about this, and their feeling was, look, we can still do tons of things that a robot cannot do. This was before COVID was declared a pandemic, and work from home raises a whole lot of issues for the call center industry, not least of which is restrictions related to the handling of clients' financial information outside of an office. So these issues haven't gone away. You know, they were ticking before, they're ticking now. COVID hasn't changed every single thing.
What are your thoughts on COVID then? You know, this is still the overarching predicament that the entire world is in. We are on the verge now of having vaccines. It seems these things seem to be getting approved, fast-tracked. We seem to have supplies on their way, pending the approval. What are your thoughts in terms of the vaccines? Is this going to open everything up? And do you think Southeast Asia, which is, I would, kind of representing a developing region, are they going to get it as quickly as the developed nations?
Look, great question. You know, there is a sense of, you know, the arrival and distribution and effectiveness of vaccines. That's been, you know, the D-Day, right? That's been the holy grail, pick your metaphor, of this whole thing since the start of the year. Look, they've got to be effective. They've got to be distributed. They've got to be administered. And then they've got to be administered in enough places with enough confidence for things like the travel industry to start opening up. You know, Singapore and Hong Kong signed an air bubble agreement a couple of months ago, but had little hesitation calling it off on the eve of its commencement, not because cases had reached the threshold that would allow for suspension of the agreement, but because they thought they might reach that threshold in coming days. So there is a high, you know, almost stratospheric aversion to risk, particularly for countries that worked hard like Singapore to get it under control. So we'll see what happens with the vaccines. You know, I worry slightly that way too much in terms of expectations for society and the economy is packed into the arrival of vaccines. But look, I'm not a medical practitioner. I don't want to get ahead of my skis there. Though that hasn't stopped some opinion columnists, but it will stop me.
It really is the event of the year and maybe the century to have these vaccines delivered. And I'm just amazed at the logistics behind it to ensure that people are going to get the vaccines, to ensure that there's no fake vaccines on the market, to ensure that the vaccines aren't intercepted and stolen or pirated, and that we can also get vaccines to the entire population, or certainly a sort of high proportion of the population. And also these vaccines, most of them need double dose, and to ensure that people come back for their second dose when they should and don't forget. It's a logistical mountain, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is.
Do you see the world overcoming this, and do you see that there is an opportunity and that it has actually accelerated globalization, it's accelerated remote work, it's accelerated kind of a linkage internationally, where previously when it involved travel, it involved more geography, that actually now the world could be better as a result of this hiatus that it's experienced in terms of the globalization and the connectivity and the tools that we have to interact with each other?
Look, I think it's way too soon to make any sort of call that's even approaching definitive about how we as a species, we as a society, individual countries have handled this pandemic. Even before most people had ever heard of Wuhan, autopsies, if you'll pardon the expression, were still being conducted of previous epidemics. There are a couple of very popular books published about 5 years ago, 10 years ago, reviewing the Spanish flu. So we are not close now to saying much, really, from a historical perspective about how we've handled this. We do know it's a very significant societal, economic, medical, you name it, event. But, you know, I'll leave the contemporaneous version of history to others. They might find they're revising it a couple of times in coming months and quarters.
Well, Dan, thank you so much for sharing your level-headed wisdom. And I encourage everyone to go and read your article in Bloomberg, which is the Chinese antidote to a COVID-battered Philippines. And I thank you, as always, for shining the light on the Philippine economy and the potential that the Philippines has. And if anyone wants to follow you or keep in contact with you, how can they do that, Dan?
At moss_eco.
Fantastic. And we'll put all of that in the show notes. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Derek. Good talking to you.
That was Daniel Moss. He's a columnist at Bloomberg Opinion based in Singapore. If you want any of the show notes, go to outsourceaccelerator.com/podcast. And as always, if you want to ask us a question, then just send us an email to ask@outsourceaccelerator.com. See you next time.